So, the danger of software patents. To understand the problem, what?
I heard your talk before.
Oh.
On the software.
Okay. By the way, I have stickers here. And when you're leaving, whenever that may be, take stickers, as many as you can make good use of, and then go and put them up in permanent places where they will support free software and the GNU project. So, to understand the issue of patents, the first thing you have to do is realize that patents have nothing in common with copyrights. They are two different areas of law that evolved separately with no relationship to each other, that apply to different things, and every detail is different. So if you learn something about copyrights, you can be almost certain that it's different for patents and vice versa. Never lump them together. It's about as useful as lumping together France and China. I mean, you're just going to get confused, and everything you think is going to be wrong if you lump together copyrights and patents. Now, it's very fashionable these days to encourage people to lump them together. Not just those two things, but many other things as well. There's a term I'm sure you've heard, quote, intellectual property, unquote, which is a big catch-all generalization that lumps together copyrights and patents and trademarks and various other less commonly encountered things. And they're all different from each other. If you try to think about them all together, you won't understand any of them. All your conclusions will be simplistic. You'll be wrong in everything, in every factual conclusion you try to reach. And when you try to look at any public policy questions, you won't be able to, because those arise from the details that are different. When you look at this broad abstraction, quote, intellectual property, unquote, you can't even see any of the public policy issues raised by copyright, or the issues raised by patents, or the issues raised by trademarks, or because they're all different issues. And if you do try to think about public policy at that broad level, all you can do is choose among a few simplistic, overgeneralized alternatives, none of which is any good. So the first step for thinking clearly about copyrights and thinking clearly about patents is disconnect them, make sure they're completely separate in your mind, and never use the term, quote, intellectual property, unquote. Now, to point out some of the biggest differences between copyrights and patents, I'll give you a list of a few. First, copyrights cover the details of a work of authorship, the details of the expression. Copyright does not cover ideas. Ideas cannot be copyrighted. On the other hand, patents always cover ideas and only ideas. That's every patent is a restriction on using a certain idea. Copyright is a restriction on copying. If you write a novel yourself and it turns out to be identical to a novel someone else published last year, and if you can prove that you spent the past year in isolation and never saw that other novel, that is a defense against a charge of copyright infringement because you didn't copy it. Well, if it's similar enough, people might presume that you copied it because the odds of your coming up with it on your own might be so unlikely. But so you'd have to prove that you didn't copy it in practical terms. In theoretical terms, they have to prove you copied it. But they might try to do it by saying, look how similar it is. This couldn't happen by accident, could it? So if it were that similar, you might, in fact, have to prove that you had not seen the other one. But if you did prove that, that would get you off the hook, because copyright restricts copying. Patents are different. A patent is an absolute monopoly on using a certain idea. Even if you can prove that you thought of it on your own, it's irrelevant. Now, copyrights last an awfully long time, up to 150 years in some cases. Patents last, I think, well, nowadays in most of the world, it's till 20 years after the application was filed, which is still quite a long time in the field of software. Now, another difference is that patents are applied for. A patent office studies the application. It's necessary to pay a considerable amount of money as the fee and pay a lot more to pay the lawyers to draw up the application. And then the patent office studies it and either issues a patent or not. Whereas copyrights happen automatically. As soon as anything is written, it's copyrighted. And another difference is that anything that you write is copyrighted if it's just if you've just chosen the words in a new way. If the details involve choices of yours, it's copyrighted. Whereas supposedly a patent has to be for an idea that is new, useful, and unobvious. Practically, so there's a threshold. And there's no threshold for copyright. There's no threshold of interestingness or true originality that anything has to meet in order to be copyrighted. Anything written is copyrighted. Practically speaking, this doesn't mean what you'd think it means, because when patent offices interpret that criterion of unobvious, it tends to be unobvious to anybody with an IQ of 60. And they have a whole series of excuses to justify this systematic stupidity when people in the field say, "You patented that! It's insane!" And they say, "Oh, you're saying that from hindsight," or, "Well, you're one of the leaders of the field. You can't judge what's obvious to an average practitioner." So that, you know, the people who are great, they have an automatic excuse to not listen to them. So the systems are very different. Most of the time when you hear people describe the patent system, they describe it from the point of view of somebody who is trying to get a patent. There's a reason for this. The patent system is a lot like a lottery. Most patents bring no benefit to the patent holders. A few of them bring in a lot of money. And you'll notice that advertisements for a lottery try to make you think about the unlikely possibility that you'll win, not the overwhelming likelihood that you're going to lose. So of course the people who run the patent system, or the people who have an interest in the existence of the patent system, people who say like patent lawyers who want your business, they're going to describe what it's like to get a patent and then go walking down the street and pulling it out and pointing it at people and saying, "Give me your money." They're not going to describe what it's like to be on the other end of the patent. So to redress that imbalance, I'm going to describe how software patents work for those who are on the receiving end, those who want to develop and release software. So what are you going to do? Suppose you want to write a program to do a certain job, and you know that there are software patents, and you want to deal with the system in the most in a way that's going to protect you from getting sued. Well, the first thing you're going to have to do is find the patents that might cover what you're trying to write. This is impossible. And the reason is that patent applications are kept secret for a certain amount of time. I believe in the UK they're published after 18 months, which still gives room for you to write a program now and a patent to appear later. And this is not just a hypothetical situation. In 1984, the Compress program was written. It's a data compression program. and it was distributed along with various Unix systems. And at the time, there was no problem with this, but in 1985, after the program was written, a patent was issued in the US on the LZW data compression algorithm used in the compress program. And the patent holder didn't do anything about this immediately because it figured, I speculate, that the patent holder, Unisys, figured, let's get everybody habituated to using this, and then we will stick them up, and they won't be able to stop. So it was several years later, they started trying to demand royalties for the use of compress, and we in the GNU project started looking for some other way to do data compression. And I found somebody who'd written the program already and decided to contribute it to us. A week before it was going to be released, I happened to see the New York Times, which didn't happen all that often, and it happened to have the weekly patent column, and it happened to say that somebody had got a patent for inventing a new method of data compression. Now, we had looked at a number of patents to try to see if this algorithm we were going to use was safe. I figured we better get this patent. And it turned out to cover exactly the program we were going to release. So that program was killed, never got anywhere. So then we eventually found somebody else who came up with another algorithm and released the program generally known nowadays as GZIP. So this is a real danger. But put that aside. You get the patents that have been issued already, or the applications that are 18 months old. So you've got a stack. Or at least you can search through all the patents that have been issued or published already. Finding the ones that are relevant to what you're trying to do is not so easy. Now, people say, well, you can use a computer now to do an automatic search, but that doesn't necessarily work. For instance, 10 years ago, everybody making a spreadsheet in the US was threatened with a lawsuit under a patent covering natural order recalculation. Natural order recalculation just means that every time one cell depends on another cell, the depending cell will be recalculated after the one it depends on. This uses an algorithm that's generally called topological sorting. The patent was applied for in 1970 and not issued until 1983, which means it expired in 2000. Anyway, if you had tried to search for that patent, you would have been out of luck, because it didn't mention the term spreadsheet. It didn't mention the term natural order or recalculation. It didn't mention the term topological sort. It was described as a patent on a technique for compiling formulas into object code. And sometimes I showed people copies of the patent and they told me, you sent me the wrong patent. Because until you read it carefully, you didn't see what it was about. So if you had tried to search automatically for that patent, you wouldn't have found anything. However, you would typically find some of the patents that are relevant to the thing you're doing. So let's suppose you've got a stack of patents on the table, and now you want to figure out just what it is you're not allowed to do. This is very hard, because patents are written in a twisted kind of legal language where things don't mean what they seem to mean. You're going to need to spend a lot of time and money to talk with a lawyer, where the lawyer is going to study these patents, and then you have to explain the things you're actually trying to write to the lawyer so that the lawyer can then figure out what the patents really imply and explain to you. Now, the opacity of patents is so great that people can't even understand the patents that they have got. In fact, Australia did a study of the patent system in the 1980s to see whether having a patent system was beneficial. And it concluded by saying that aside from international pressure, there was no indication that having a patent system did Australia any good at all. And they would recommend making patents narrower, harder to get, and shorter in length. One of the things that they quoted in this was a fact that engineers don't look at patents to learn anything. You know, supposedly, that's one of the benefits that society gets from having a patent system is disclosure of ideas. But because they're disclosed in such an opaque fashion, nobody even tries. There's only one reason to read a patent, and that's to see the bad news. And they quoted an engineer as saying, "I can't recognize my own inventions in patentees." And I've had an example of this. In the 80s, an engineer called Paul Heckel got a couple of patents on ideas I find extremely hard to describe in any short way. On a number of occasions, I looked hard at those patents trying to find some way I could put in a nutshell what they cover, and I can't. But when he saw a HyperCard, he didn't think it resembled what he had patented. Then his lawyer told him that there was a way of interpreting the patent such that HyperCard infringed it. So he then threatened to sue Apple. And Apple didn't listen. They said, go away. So he then started threatening to sue their customers for merely using HyperCard. And at that point, Apple settled with him. And we don't know how much money they paid him. So when I told this story once, while I was giving a speech at Stanford, this same speech more or less, he was in the audience and he stood up and said, "That's not true, I just didn't know the scope of my protection." And I said, "That's what I said." And he didn't dare comment for the rest of my speech after that. So, in fact, you're going to have to spend a lot of money finding out what these patents do to you. And ultimately, you'll get an answer like this. If you do something in this area, you're almost certain to lose. If you do something in this area, there's a substantial chance that you will lose. And if you really want to be safe, you better stay out of this area. And, of course, there's a sizable element of chance in the outcome of any lawsuit. So now that you have a predictable terrain for doing business, what are your options? Well, there are three of them. You can try to avoid the patent. You can try to license the patent. Or you can challenge the validity of the patent in court. Each of these options is sometimes workable and sometimes not. First, avoiding the patent. Well, sometimes that's easy. If some very specific feature is patented, just don't put in that feature. Well, that may be okay in many cases. You know, the users might miss that feature, but maybe the program's still good enough that they'll use it. In some cases, though, that's a disaster. Because in some cases, due to commonly accepted standards, there is only one thing that will do. Nothing else will do. Even if it's superior inherently, it's still no use in practice. Now, we came up with a GZIP program to replace compress. And that was fine for people who wanted to do data compression. Because if you want to do data compression, you can get any data compression program. And if the system distributor provides you with GZIP because he can safely do so and doesn't provide you with compress because he'd get sued, you'll see GZIP and you'll use GZIP. And if somebody wants to unpack that file, he or she will get GZIP and unpack it. So that's fine. But what about if your goal is not to do data compression but to put an image on the web? Well, people were using GIF format, which also use the same LZW compression algorithm. So Unisys started threatening people who were distributing software that could produce GIF files. And then they started threatening people who had websites that had GIF files, saying, pay us a license because you don't know whether your GIF files were made with an officially licensed program or not. And so we started saying to everybody, stop using GIF files. GIF files are a trap. And even if you don't get sued, you're luring other people into the trap with you. And they may get sued. We all are in this together. We all have to get out of it together. We all must stop using GIF format. And we couldn't budge them. Today, 10 years later, more than 10 years later, the community is still almost entirely using GIF format, because its inertia was too great. Those users weren't thinking of choosing between. For one thing, the end users who could have chosen what format to use, they couldn't just choose any format they wanted. They had to choose a format that browsers would support. And you know, our community developed another format which used the gzip compression algorithm. It did better compression. You know, it would compress smaller. People wouldn't switch to it. They switched to it when they wanted to do data compression, but they didn't switch in image formats. And so people are still stuck in the trap. The patent's going to expire soon, I think. So, you know, in another year or so, we'll get out of this pitfall. But it shows how dangerous this is. And when a company has enough clout, it can artificially make something the standard. Something that they chose because it happens to fall within a patent they were able to get. Digital Equipment Corporation did this a long time ago. People were making serial line controllers, peripherals for a digital computer. And Digital wiped this out by they patented a technique where the terminal controller shared memory with the CPU and it used a ring buffer, and the computer told the peripheral how big to make the ring buffer by storing the information in a place in memory. The buffer sizes, for instance. So the terminal controller would see that and they would both establish the same size ring buffer so they could talk to each other. Now, this is one possible technique. It's not the only one. It's not clearly better. The point is that Digital was able to get a patent on this, and then they set up the operating system on the main computer to use this kind of communication. And so anybody who wanted to make a terminal controller, a serial line controller, would have to use the same protocol, and they weren't allowed to do that. So Digital was able to wipe out competition, wipe out plug-compatible serial line controllers. Now, of course, the danger is that Microsoft will do something like this. And they can get a patent on something. You know, they can find some obscure thing, which is not better. It's not really you can't call it progress in the field. It's just different enough that they can patent it. And then they make it the de facto standard using their clout, and then everybody is over a barrel. And as we saw with the example of the Ping image format, the patent-free replacement for the GIF image format, even when you offer people a superior alternative, they can't switch away from a de facto standard. Now, in some cases, a patent will be so broad that there's simply no way to avoid it. Consider, for instance, the patent covering, the now expired patent covering public key encryption, a tremendously important field that was essentially off limits for more than a decade. Anyone trying to use it got shot down. Now, sometimes people, once they've started to recognize the faults of the patent system, but clinging to the idea that a patent system is a good thing, they say, well, the problem is just the stupid patents, the patents on these things that are trivial. If only the patents office could do its job well, then the patent system would be okay. Well, consider this public key encryption patent. That's a brilliant idea. And yet the patent did tremendous harm. If there had been no software patents, those professors would certainly have published their idea anyway. We would all have been able to use it. In some cases, you can avoid a patent by eliminating some particular feature. For instance, at one point there was the users of the word processor Xywrite received a downgrade in the mail. The word processor had a certain feature where you could define an abbreviation. You could define a sequence of letters as an abbreviation. And when you type that sequence followed by a space or any punctuation, that short sequence would then replace itself automatically with the expansion. And so then somebody patented this, and the developers of Xywrite tried negotiating with him, but he kept changing his demands, so eventually they gave up trying to negotiate with him, and they said, we'll take out the feature, and they sent people a downgrade. But they contacted me about this because it turns out that I had put a similar feature into the original Emacs in the 1970s. So I know I've had at least one patentable idea in my life because somebody else patented it later. So my work was probably prior art for that patent, but they decided to just take the feature out. Well, yeah, you can take some features out and maybe the users will still like your program. If you look at a word processor today, you'll see hundreds of different features, any of which might be patented by somebody else already. And are you going to take all those features out? Maybe then people will think that your word processor is no good. Maybe they won't use it. So that is the issue of avoiding the patent. The option of trying to avoid the patent. Another option is trying to license the patent. Now, this option is not always available. Patent holders are not required to offer you a license at all. A patent holder can say, I don't want any competitors. Go get lost. And this happens to people sometimes. A while ago, in the League for Programming Freedom, which is an organization formed to fight against these kinds of restrictions on what kind of software you can write, we were contacted by somebody whose family business was making computerized casino games. And he was being threatened by a patent holder. A patent holder who was not going to offer him any license, who was just saying, I don't want you competing with us. Go away. And I saw this patent. He showed me the patent. It was a patent covering terminals, putting more than one terminal on a network, where each terminal was capable of playing more than one different game and was capable of showing you more than one session of games at any one time. These were multiplayer games. Now, one thing I realized from that is that there was no invention there. If you take machines that are running time-sharing systems and you put them on a network, if they can play games, they automatically have this feature of supporting more than one kind of game and letting you play more than one at once. It just has to have a Windows system on it, right? You know, you take a machine with a Unix-like system and X Windows running, and it'll be able to do this. It didn't even need to be that. You know, you could have used, say, a Macintosh, even to do this. Where's the invention? This is what I mean when I say that the patent systems systematically adopt an absurd threshold of what constitutes an invention. They'll call things an invention if they just haven't seen them before. And they think that being able to do two or more of something when previously other people did only one is always an invention. They don't realize that in software, it is always trivial. If you can do one of something, you can make it a subroutine, and you can do N of them. If you can do it once, you can do it N times. If you can do one thing, you could do several different things. These are basic principles of system design. We don't need to invent them every time. I've seen many patents where a large part of the structure of the computer itself is included in the description of the system and in the claims. Because if you didn't do that, they would be obviously so trivial that it would be laughed at. But when you start padding it with all the various parts of a computer, like, you know, registers and ALU and memory, and maybe a network interface and a disk, and describing all the things that they do with each other as part of the description of this so-called invention, then it starts looking complicated enough that the patent office will say, oh, this is an invention. They don't realize it's trivial. They can't even keep track of what they've issued as patents. For instance, the LZW data compression algorithm has actually been patented twice in the US by two different companies. So there are two different companies that claim to be the real patent holder for this algorithm. And that's not the only case. Remember I told you about the program that was killed because 1 week before its release, I found out that that algorithm had been patented? Well, that algorithm was patented again a few years later, and somebody bought that patent and used it to sue Microsoft. They claimed to be this little company that Microsoft was putting out of business, so they were suing Microsoft for patent infringement. It wasn't widely reported that one of the patents that they were using to do this, they had purchased from somebody else just before the lawsuit. So what you see is that the patent office can't even keep track of things itself, and there's a reason for that. It's not that the people working on examining software patent applications are incompetent. No, you see, for patents covering physical processes or physical machines, there's some substance there that you can use to ground yourself. You know, if there's a process that involves certain chemical inputs and certain chemical outputs, and if somebody else applies for a patent on the same thing, you can recognize the inputs are the same and the outputs are the same, and you can realize that you better work hard on comparing those two. But for an activity that's essentially mathematical, there's nothing to tie you down to earth. The two patents for the LZW algorithm don't look similar. You have to study them hard before you recognize that they're about the same thing. And the patent examiners don't have time to take every pair of patents in the same large area and study them both together carefully. They couldn't possibly do that. So they're going to make these kinds of stupid decisions. It's not quite right to call them mistakes, because that implies that they're aberrations. No, it's systematic that that's going to happen. It's systematic that they're going to judge poorly. Anyway, to get back to the question of licensing a patent, which this has all been a big digression from, sometimes you are offered a license. For instance, the patent holder of the natural order recalculation patent was offering a license for 5% of the gross sales of every spreadsheet. And that, I was told, was the cheap pre-lawsuit price, that anyone who was going to fight a suit and get defeated would have to pay more. Now, you might be able to afford one such license, but what happens if you need to get 20 different such licenses for your product? Now you've agreed to pay 100% of the gross. Your income is going to be zero. What if you need 21 such licenses? Then each time you sell a copy, you have to pay out more than you took in. practically speaking, people in business have told me that two or three such licenses would make a project economically unfeasible. But there is a case in which getting licenses to use patents works very well, and that's for big companies. Because the big companies, the global mega corporations, tend to have lots of patents, and they cross-license with each other, and then they're all fine. Of course, this is a game that the rest of us can't play, because we might get a few patents, but we're surely not going to get the thousands that, say, IBM has. Where very few small businesses even get a dozen patents. You know, that happens once in a while, but it's not easy. Whereas these big companies get hundreds, or sometimes thousands. Now, there's a myth that patents will, quote, protect, unquote, that's a propaganda term, the, quote, small inventor, unquote. There's a myth of the starving genius who has spent years in his attic coming up with a marvelous new way, revolutionary way to do such and such. And as soon as he starts making it, some big company will come along and compete with him. And of course, it will take all the business away from him. And he will starve, is the word that they like to use. Now, this is a rather ridiculous scenario because, for one thing, progress in a high-tech field today isn't made usually by somebody in an attic. It's made by people who are part of a community of research and development. And it's usually not made by an individual. It's probably made by a team. And if worse came to worst, these people could probably get jobs. So they're not going to starve. And meanwhile, even if a big company is free to compete with him, it might prefer to buy him out. And even if it doesn't buy him out, just because the big company is competing with him doesn't mean he loses all the business, because small businesses are more agile. That's why there are small businesses. So very likely he might not get the gigantic mass market, but he'll get specialty markets because he'll be doing something in advance of what the big companies can do. So the scenario is not realistic, and the disaster it predicts is not realistic either. But let's suppose that that situation existed, and let's suppose that this starving genius, or what might be starving genius, has a patent. And suppose he says to IBM, "You can't compete with me because I've got this patent and I'm now protected." IBM says, "Well, let's look at your product. Well, we have this patent and this one and this one and this one and this one, which are infringed by various parts of your product. So how about if you negotiate a cross-license? And by the way, if you think you can beat all these in court, we'll just look for some more." At that point, the small inventor says, "Okay," and signs a cross-license, which means that IBM is now allowed to compete with him. So the very same problem that the patents was supposed to prevent is going to happen anyway. So basically, the patent system doesn't really protect the small inventor. That's a myth. It might in a world of other small inventors, but it doesn't protect him from mega corporations. Now, IBM has written about this in Think magazine, issue number 5, I believe it was 1990. There was an article about the benefit IBM got from its 9,000 active U.S. patents. And it said that there was a direct benefit of collecting royalties from them, but much more important was the indirect benefit of getting access to the ideas patented by others. And they estimated that this was an order of magnitude greater than the value of the royalties that IBM took in. What this means is that IBM is so big that IBM sees the average performance of the patent system. It's like buying a million lottery tickets. For a small inventor, the patent system is like a lottery. For IBM, IBM is big enough it can average things out. And what it sees is that the problem that other people's patents would have caused for it is 10 times the value of the royalties it collects from its own patents. Now, in fact, that 10 times as big harm doesn't happen to IBM because IBM avoids it by cross-licensing. But you can't avoid it by cross-licensing, so for you, on the average, that 10 times as much harm as good is going to happen to you. IBM, of course, gets only benefit from the patent system because it avoids most of the harm through cross-licensing. IBM avoids the harm because it has so many patents. But you can't get that many. You can't avoid the harm the way IBM does. The harm is really going to happen to you. Now, IBM can't avoid all of the harm because some patents are held by patent holders that don't make any products. All they do is squeeze money out of people. And because there are no patents on kinds of lawsuits, IBM can't make them cross-license. Even IBM can't make them cross-license. For instance, the patent holder with the natural order recalculation patent didn't make anything except trouble. You know, their business was to go to people and threaten to sue them and say, pay me money. And so IBM would not have been able to threaten to countersue them for patent infringement. At the time, I guess IBM didn't make a spreadsheet. I don't know whatever. Well, then they bought Lotus, so I guess they did have a spreadsheet. I don't know what happened. But you know, the technique that IBM uses, having many patents and cross-licensing, doesn't always work, but it works most of the time. And it works against those small inventors. So getting a license for the patent may be a solution, but it often has big drawbacks, and sometimes you can't do it. The third possibility is to challenge the validity of the patent in court. Now, whether you'd have a chance of winning depends on a lot of historical accidents. What information was published when, and whether you can find proof today that it was published at that time, together with a lot of detailed things that happened during the examination of the patent. It's basically these historical accidents add up to a roll of the dice, except that you can to some extent find out what the dice are showing before you go to court. So of course you would do that. You would investigate all these details before you really went to court. The other problem is that at least in the, well, it's very expensive. Now in the US it's really expensive. It costs millions of dollars on each side. I heard of a patent lawsuit that where Qualcomm was sued and lost, and they had to pay $13 million, of which most went to pay the lawyers on both sides. It's probably not as expensive in the UK, but it's still too expensive for a lot of software developers. And the result is that even if the patent is ridiculous, it's still an effective weapon. Being threatened with a lawsuit using a patent that is pretty clearly invalid is still going to ruin your whole year. And people who defend the patent system often refer to the fact that courts can overturn invalid patents as if that were going to make the problem a non-issue. Oh, we don't have to worry about the possibility of invalid patents because the courts will overturn them, right? They're ignoring what real life, what practical problems are like. So sometimes these historical accidents have worked out in your favor, and you've got a reasonably good chance of invalidating the patent. Other times, if you can spend the money, and other times they didn't work out in your favor and you have no chance. So with these three options, you have to confront one patent after another. Now, each time a patent comes at you, you've got to pick one of these three options. And each one of them may or may not be available for independent reasons. So there's nothing that says that you're always going to be able to do one or the other. Sometimes you're going to be stuck. And the result is that software development becomes like crossing a minefield. At each step, probably you're not going to step on a patent. But to get through the whole field, to get to the other side without stepping on a patent, that's not so easy. Now, sometimes people have asked me, if patents are okay in other fields, why should software be an exception? Of course, that question is a biased and unfair question. It presumes that we have some kind of duty to suffer with a patent system, and that it would be best if nobody could escape. Now, actually, in general, if there's some kind of calamity, we should be glad every time someone escapes. Every time somebody does not get cancer, that's a good thing. You know, the fact, we shouldn't say, well, those people got cancer, so why shouldn't you? Why should you be any different, right? Of course you shouldn't get cancer. We hope you won't get cancer. We hope your project won't be ruined by a software patent. But there is a good question hidden in there, which is, how is software different from other fields? Is it a good thing? You know, how do we decide which fields should have patents and which fields should not? Which differences between fields are relevant to this question? The difference between software and other fields is that software packages are far more complex than anything else people normally design. To design a physical system or a circuit with a million components is a mega project. To design a program with a million components in its source code, well, each operator is a component, a pretty small component. That program might have 300,000 lines. A few people will write that in a few years. It's normal. This means that we get certain benefits in the area of software. You can do something very complicated, and it's not that hard to do it, which is why we do these things this big. We write programs this big, because it can be done, whereas it's not feasible to design a mechanical or chemical or electrical system that complex. You just couldn't afford to design such a system. Now, the result is that software systems, real software systems, have more different things going on in them, more points which you could be sued for by one patent or another. If you look at a word processor today, you'll see hundreds of different features, any of which might be patented by somebody already. A combination of two of them together might be patented by somebody. The technique used to implement one of them might be patented by somebody. There are a lot of things in it that might be patented. A system that's smaller and simpler will have fewer things in it that might infringe a patent. So it's fewer points of vulnerability. In other words, patents relate to products in different ways in different fields. On one extreme, there are pharmaceuticals, where typically an entire chemical formula gets patented, meaning it's one chemical that has been patented. So for that chemical, there's one patent. Well, if you then develop a different chemical, it's not patented already. You would be then the only one who would get the patent on your new invention, this new chemical. Then there, you know, other fields are in the middle. You know, sometimes a product will have various things in it that might be patented, but not to the extreme level of software. Well, but why is software different in that way? The reason is, in all the other fields, people are trying to deal with physical systems, and they have to cope with the perversity of matter. Whereas we, in software, are writing down combinations of mathematical formulas, and they do what they're defined to do. When you're making a physical system, you don't have a definition of the properties of matter. No, matter does what it does. You might think it's supposed to do one thing, but you build it, it really does something else. Tough. Your model is wrong. What matters is what physical objects do, not what your model said. But in our case, the model is the definition. A program does what the constructs are defined to do. So you can build a castle in the air supported by a thin thread, and it'll stay up because the definition says that this thread is stiff. So it stays up. Wouldn't work with physical substances. We don't work with physical substances. When I put an if statement inside of a while statement, I don't have to worry about whether the loop will run at the wrong frequency and the if statement will start vibrating and will fracture. I don't have to worry whether in this vibration it will rub away part of the while statement. I don't have to worry whether some kind of substance from the environment will get in between the if statement and the while statement and corrode them. I don't have to worry about whether there'll be so much voltage drop through the while statement that the if statement won't work right. I don't have to worry that it will run at the wrong frequency and it will produce it will induce a current in some other part of the program that will make the other values be wrong. I don't have to worry whether I can physically assemble the if statement inside the while statement. I don't have to figure out the order of assembly of the parts of this program because there's one copy command that'll copy any program. You know, even if I'm putting them on a CD, well, you know, the CD manufacturing plant will just take any series of bits as the master and make CDs from them. I don't have to design the product carefully to be capable of being physically assembled. And I don't have to worry if the if statement should break or corrode or degrade somehow, how am I going to get access to pull out the broken one and put in the replacement? I don't have to worry when I use a variable in the program that I might use it too many times and exceed the fan-out limit. I don't have to worry when I use a variable, whether it's been too soon after I set the variable and how much capacitance the variable has, and whether it's had time to charge up. Just so many problems that we don't have to worry about. And this is what enables us to make bigger systems. You see, the intelligence of designers is the same, whether they're building these mechanical systems or electrical ones or software. But the people designing mechanical systems and electrical ones, they have all these problems to deal with, all these constraints, whereas we don't. So the same size system is hard for them and easy for us. But whenever people find that a certain kind of job is easy, what do? They do bigger problems. Eventually, you do it big enough, it gets to be hard. And that's what we've done in software. Because it's inherently easier, but we have the same intelligence as the people in the other fields, we take on bigger problems than they can do. And that's why you'll hear people sometimes talking about the software design crisis and how hard software is to design. The reason is they're not comparing it with other fields. They're just looking at it absolutely. We've undertaken these big jobs that you do them big enough, they get to be hard. That's why software development is hard, because we're doing these things sometimes that have millions of lines. Gets to be hard. So this is why software is different from other fields, It's easier to design, and once you've designed it, it's easier to make the copies. You don't need to design a factory specially to make the product you want to make. You have a copy command available to make copies of whatever program. And because of this, we'll make these programs that have potentially could be hit by hundreds of patents. And people making a physical system, it's going to be much simpler. The number of patents they could be hit by is smaller, and their operation is involves so much money and investment anyway that they can deal with the patent system and handle a few patent negotiations that they're likely to have. Whereas we're taking advantage of the fact that software is so much cheaper to design, the whole operation can be so cheap that we can't afford to deal with these potentially dozens of patents we might run into. In fact, because these software packages are so big, it means that the big job is not generally coming up with any ideas to use. The big job is writing it all. And in fact, if you've got enough people working on writing software, they're going to have ideas. So the ideas come as a byproduct of having people working on writing programs. And this means that the basic idea of the patent system makes no sense in our field. The idea of the patent system is to artificially incentivize people to have ideas and develop ideas. Well, if that's the limiting factor, such a system might perhaps be a good idea. But when this artificial system to incentivize new ideas causes trouble for people who are writing the systems, it could even get in the way of having more ideas. Because the ideas we get is a byproduct of having people think about, how am I going to write a program to do this or that? It's something they do along the way of writing this tremendous stack of code. I once brought a stack of paper this tall. It was actually four pages on each sheet of paper, which was the printout of the GNU-C compiler. And I handed it to people from the US Patent Office when I was speaking at their hearing, and said, would you like to tell me how many patents this infringes? Because they don't know, and I can't possibly know either. When you have these programs, and this was, by the way, something that was written with zero investment. When you have systems that are that complicated, a patent system just gets in the way. Now, I can say this and ask you to see it by common sense, but you might not be satisfied with that. There is now mathematical modeling showing how, in a field where there is incremental innovation, having a patent system can obstruct progress rather than promoting progress as it's supposed to do and as it justifies itself by claiming to do. It can obstruct progress, and if you want to see the paper, take a look at www.researchoninnovation, that's research on innovation but run together as one word, .org/patents.pdf. And if you wish to study the mathematics, you can do so. So what can we do about this problem? The best thing for a country to do is to avoid having software patents at all. Europe is right now fighting over whether to have software patents at all. And a lot of the impetus for software patents in Europe comes from the UK Patent Office, which has fallen under the sway of the ideology of the US and of the big companies that figure they're going to gain if they can have software patents. But other countries are resisting the idea. France is against it, Germany is against it. The Spanish government just said that they believe the decision has to be delayed because it's too important and there are problems and it needs to be studied carefully. the decision can be resisted, but it's vital for people in the UK to go to their patent office and say, and go to the ministries, which are above the patent office, and say, these people are making a bad mistake. If you're interested in getting involved with this, there are people working on it already. You should look at ffii.org, which is a site that gives a lot of information about the battle over software patents in Europe. ffii.org. And then write to the person who maintains that site, Hartmut Pilch. That's phm@ffii.org. And he can put you in touch with people in the UK fighting against software patents in Europe. And if enough join in for this fight, we may win. It's not as if it were a hopeless fight. There are a lot of people opposing this, and even some governments opposing it. We may win. But we're more likely to win if you get involved actively now.
Can I just say, in the UK, the Association for Free Software, which has recently been formed and affiliated to the Free Software Foundation Europe, is gearing up to join the campaign against software patents. And you can find out on how to get on the mailing list and join in by going to www.affs.org.uk.
I should point out that although the free software community has taken the lead in Europe in fighting against software patents, the danger of software patents applies to anyone who develops software and anyone who uses software. If businesses that use software realize what software patents can do to them, because remember, the users of a program can get sued, not just the developer, they would make this come to an end pretty fast. But they're not aware of it for the most part. They don't realize the danger it would be. Software patents are essentially a new kind of bureaucracy that would tie up every computer user. And since most businesses are computer users, in particular, it would tie up every business in Europe. Businesses don't like to be tied up in bureaucracy. Sometimes there is a real purpose to be served in having a bureaucracy. You know, it's very important to have a bureaucracy keep track of movements of animals. Painful as that might seem to the businesses being regulated, it's necessary. But software patents don't serve any good purpose. I've been in the field since before the U.S. had software patents, and there is no improvement in progress as a result of software patents. Before there were software patents, people developed software, and most of the software they developed was not free, so they kept the details secret, but they published the interesting ideas because they knew that the ideas were not the most important, not the most crucial thing. They felt it was okay to publish the ideas, and they would get kudos for that. So, you know, the companies realized, we better let our engineers publish their ideas, or we won't have good engineers working for us. And after software patents, they still kept the source code secret, except for us in the free software movement, but most of the companies kept the source code secret, and they patented the ideas. There was no improvement. There was just a step for the worse. And you'll find people arguing that the U.S. is ahead in using information technology, and the U.S. has software patents, and this shows that software patents are a good thing. Well, the U.S. was ahead in using information technology before it had software patents in 1980. So one has nothing to do with the other. But you'll find the advocates of software patents in Europe will make illogical claims and false claims. They figure that they'll be believed because nobody will contradict them. That's what they're relying on. So it's necessary for Europeans to stand up and put an end to this. The best way I know of to explain the harm done by software patents to somebody who doesn't know much about programming is to make an analogy with symphonic music. Because a symphony also has a lot of details in it that have to be written. And it has a number of ideas in it as well. So imagine that the governments of Europe had decided in the 1700s to promote the progress of symphonic music by establishing a system of musical idea patents so that any idea for what to do in a composition that you could write down in words could be patented. And so now imagine that you are Beethoven and you want to write a symphony, but you don't want to get sued for patent infringement. So you're going to have to work very hard to study all the patents and make sure you avoid all the ideas that have been patented. And there might be patents on short motifs that are not copyrightable. There might be patents on chord progressions. There might be patents on combinations of instruments playing at the same time, or you know, anything you could think of. Sorry, what? No, I don't think so. I know, well, one time Microsoft did get sued by a company and for patent infringement. And as that's the case I mentioned, where this it was a small company, Microsoft was competing with them, so they bought a patent to use to sue Microsoft. And as far as people could tell, the jury decided the case based on their prejudice against Microsoft. So Microsoft lost. But you can't count on that to happen all the time. I don't know. I don't know. I wouldn't make that claim.
Are there engineers being strangled?
No, I think they basically buy out those companies. So, well, of course you can find them. If somebody's going to threaten to sue you for patent infringement, you know where to find him. Well, the point is, Microsoft has plenty of money, so they can pay for patent licenses if necessary. They're also getting a substantial number of software patents themselves so that they can make people cross-license if they have any products. That is, people who have any products can be made by Microsoft to cross-license with Microsoft.
You don't think that American software is becoming
crud? I wouldn't make that claim. What I would claim is that software development gets to be risky because you never know which decision is going to get you sued. Practically speaking, you see, you can't afford in most of the time to do a careful patent search. You just have to try walking across the minefield and hope. You'll find out if you stepped on a patent eventually. It is, but that's the way it's done. Anyway, so imagine that you are Beethoven, you now want to write a symphony and not get sued. You're going to find that writing a non-patent infringing symphony is harder than writing a good symphony. And if you were Beethoven, you would complain very loudly about this. That's the kind of person he was. And of course, the patent holders would have said, well, you're just jealous because we had all these ideas before you. Why don't you try coming up with your own ideas? Now, as it happens, Beethoven had a lot of new musical ideas, as composers go. But in order to write recognizable music, he had to use old ideas too. In any one symphony, he'd have to use a lot of ideas, some of which might be new and shocking even. But a lot of them would be old, and they might be patented by people already. And nobody is so brilliant that he can reinvent all of music from nothing in a totally different way. Nobody's so brilliant he can reinvent all of information technology afresh in a totally different way. We all have to use the ideas that already exist together with such new ideas as we have. Now, Pierre Boulez said he would reinvent music in a totally different way. And he tried, and nobody listens. And that's what happens, you see. If you try to do music in a way that is unrecognizably strange, nobody wants it. And the same with software. If you try to do software in a way that's unrecognizably different, probably no one's going to want to use it because it's too strange to them, and they'd have to learn too much. So, in a sense, those patent holders, when they say, go reinvent, if you don't like our patents, just go reinvent the whole field from nothing in a totally different way, they're setting a hoop that nobody could ever jump through, and using that as an excuse to clamp down. Now, I don't predict that software patents will make all software disappear, or that it will be so many lawsuits that everything will come to a halt. Most of the times they don't have a lawsuit. Most of the time they negotiate something. But it puts a big drag on the system, and it puts some small businesses out of business, and it allows big companies to control things more. And something of great importance to me, it often prohibits free software. See, we can't pay for a patent license. The usual patent license involves a certain fee per copy. If the program is free, then all of you can make more copies. How can I pay a fee per copy? Even if that fee were one millionth of a pence, right? How could I count how many millions I have to pay? The total amount might be something I can afford, but in order to keep track of the number of copies, I'd have to make the program non-free. And if you, the users, if you had to pay for permission to make and redistribute copies, then the program would be non-free. Because free software means you are free to make these copies and redistribute them. If you have to pay for permission, you're not free to do it. So, one way or the other, these patent licenses make the program non-free. Now, sometimes we may be able to buy a patent license with a lump sum. If we can do it, that solves the problem in one instance. But the advantage of free software is we can do things with even less money than non-free software can do it with, which means we can't afford to buy a lot of patent licenses. It basically wipes us out. This is why the free software community was especially quick to recognize the danger of software patents and why in Europe it has taken the lead. But as I've said, it's not just free software developers who have recognized the danger. So at this point, I should take questions, since it's been almost 3 hours. Now, what we should do is there's a microphone for questions, and somebody should hold it in one place, and people who want to ask questions should come up, line up there so that they can ask questions, and that way we won't have to bore everybody while we bring the microphone over to someplace. And by the way, if you're leaving, do come here and take stickers. Take as many stickers as you can make good use of.
You've been talking a lot of subversions. I have some criminal syndicalism to go with it.
Okay. So, are you going to hold the microphone there? Come here if you have questions to ask. Make a line and we'll get to you one by one.
And if anybody else wants a copy of that CD I just gave them, I'll sell them for about £3.
Oh, and if anyone wants to buy one of these books, then they're for sale.
I can't get Vietnam BSD to work.
Well, thank you. I was spellbound for the 3 hours anyway. You gave us some pointers to what to do about patents, but I got the impression that for copyright it was kind of all over. Can you give us some pointers to how we fix copyright problems?
It's not exactly all over, but there isn't such an organized effort that I know of. What happened is the EU adopted a copyright directive that has requirements somewhat like the US Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Now the various countries in the EU have to implement this. They have a certain amount of leeway in deciding how to implement it. And therefore, on a country-by-country basis, people need to push for less harsh implementations. It would also be desirable, of course, to repeal that directive. At the moment, there isn't the constituency to do so. When people become more aware of the wrong that has been done to them, maybe someday it will be possible. This is why I don't know who to recommend. Do you? Ross Anderson? Keegan, you said. I don't remember that name at all. But you could presumably find him on the net. And would they be able to write to your Association for Free Software and get connected with these people?
Yeah, well, it'll be in the archives, the discussion on it.
So you're saying that the archives on www.affs.org.uk? Okay, so through that site, people can get to these archives and find. How about if you put in a prominent place on that site tonight, a pointer to where people should go if they want to help with that campaign?
Right, well, I won't be able to get hold of anyone tonight, but I could do that very soon.
So he says that very soon. He can't do it tonight, but he can do it very soon. The mic won't be picking you up, you see, so I have to repeat the important things. It's Association for Free Software, AFFS.
I've just remembered the organization. It's the CDR, Campaign for Digital Rights.
Ah, Campaign for Digital Rights is the name of the organization that is fighting for a gentler implementation of the EU Copyright Directive. More questions?
Would it be possible to have a free patent? Like get a patent for something and then license it in such a way that you give it away for free to people, and this would give you some kind of comeback against companies. Yeah.
The idea basically makes no sense. You see, patents and copyrights are so different that a strategy that works with copyrights is very unlikely to make any sense for patents. What could be done is we could try to get some patents and use them for cross-licensing leverage. It's just hard to do that. It's expensive. You have to recognize that there's an idea you could patent. And not only that, once you've got a patent, you then have to pay every so often to keep it valid. And those payments can get to be quite expensive. So the result is, unless you're using the patent to squeeze money out of people, you won't be able to keep it in force even. So the system is designed to make that very hard to do. With copyright, it turns out it's easier to do.
When you're writing software, how much of what you write isn't obvious to you as you're going along? They're saying it must be not obvious when you're applying for a patent. How much of what?
Please note that patents don't cover software, they cover ideas. It's impossible for there to be a patent on a program. Yes. The text of a program is copyrightable, but patents would only cover ideas in their generality, not the specific code. Now, in the code of a program, there'll be lots of details where I might get it wrong the first time, so it's not obvious what that detail has to say, but the job it's doing might be obvious. Questions? I guess 3 hours. Oh, there's a person. Please come to the microphone.
With the exponential growth of patents and the impossibility of comparing one against the other, and all the problems with genetic patents, is it now time for a complete reform of the patent system as we've come into this millennium?
Well, it might make sense to mostly abolish the patent system. given that it's mostly used by large companies to lock up fields. There may be some fields where some kinds of patents are a good idea. I'm not an expert on all fields, and I don't want to make a general statement about them all. It would make sense to re-examine this from scratch, to take it on blind faith that the patent system promotes progress is a foolish approach. It's clear that the patent system benefits certain interests which have enough money to push for it to be continued and extended. It's not clear that the patent system in general accomplishes the goal of promoting progress of the useful arts. Questions, or should we declare the speech over? Going, let's be gone.